Hey, podcast listeners, this is Michael Shelley speaking to you. Tommy Rowe was a guest on this program 2009. He was in Mexico at a wedding during that interview, and we talked about his retirement. He was just not interested in playing anymore. Here we are a few years later, 2013. He's playing a gig in New York City at B.B. King's. He's got a new record out, and we talk about those things in this brand new interview. And then once it's over, you get to hear the entire 2009 interview. So this podcast has both Tommy Rowe interviews right in a row. Take a look at WFMU.org/Michael for the list of upcoming guests and, of course, the archives of every single previous interview ever. It's all there. Send me an email, michaels@wfmu.org, if you like. And now here are two interviews with the great Tommy Rowe. Never knew a girl like the little Sheila. Her name drives me insane. Sweet little girl, that's my little Sheila. Man, this little girl is fine. Said she'd never leave me. But true love will never die. We're so doggone happy just being around together. Man, this little girl is fine. Said she'd never leave me. But true love will never die. We're so doggone happy just being around together. Man, this little girl is fine. Yeah, this little girl is fine.
Ooh, yeah! There is Tommy Rowe and the Satins, the first version of Sheila, and Tommy joins us on the phone. Tommy, good morning. Welcome to WFMU. How are you?
Good morning, Mike. I'm doing great.
Now,
well,
I don't
playing the retro versions, huh?
Yeah. Well, that version is terrific. There's something great about it. I don't know if you remember 2009. You were on this program. I think you were calling from a wedding you were in Mexico or something like that. And you were.
Oh yeah.
And we talked a lot about how you were retired, how you were done with showbiz. You decided to just sit back and relax and enjoy the rest of your life. And here we are a few years later. You got a big gig at B.B. King's coming up on Monday, and you got a new CD out called Devil's Soul Pile. What happened?
Well, you know, retiring in the show business is kind of a joke, I think. I think Cher has retired four times.
Right.
And, you know, Sinatra retired a couple of times. So, what happened with me is I got tired of traveling. You know, the traveling thing was just getting to, I was doing over 100 dates a year before I retired. So, I thought, my gosh, I'm tired of this. I'm just going to hang it up and play some golf. But, you know, you can only play so much golf. And then my old friend Rick Levy kept calling me about doing a gig here and doing a gig there. And I finally took him up on it 2 years ago. And we did three dates up in Canada. I had so much fun with him, I decided to give it another go.
And now you're back. Well, it's everybody's gain, I suppose. Yeah, you know, you can only do anything too much. And traveling, it really has gotten worse lately, too. So that kind of, it's not like the 60s where you just kind of jumped on a bus and you were, you know,
right.
20 years old and sleeping.
Yesterday, flying up here to Baltimore, when I left Los Angeles, we sat on the tarmac for 2 hours before we left.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some things never change. The traveling is still tough, but I'm not doing it as much, so it's okay.
Yeah. Well, if folks come over to B.B. King's Monday to see you, what kind of a show, what happens these days at a Tommy Rowe show?
Well, I'm doing kind of what you were playing on the radio. I'm digging back and doing, like, B-sides in my show. I get a lot of requests on my website for kind of obscure Tommy Rowe records, you know, and so I'm throwing a few of those into the show. I'm doing three songs from my new CD, Devil Soul Pile, which did very well last year. It's number one on the independent AC chart. So, you know, I'm doing that, and then I do a Q&A session in the middle of the show, which is always a lot of fun because I kind of get out in the audience, get up close and personal with the folks, and they ask me questions, and you never know what they're going to ask. Sometimes they're really far out questions, and that's really what makes it fun. You know, I got to really think on my feet, so you never know what they're going to ask. But we have a lot of fun. Of course, I do all the hits, you know, Dizzy and Sweet Pea and Sheila and all the songs that did well for me in the 60s.
That sounds like fun. 11 top 40 hits. That is a lot. You know, I was thinking about this, and I think Sheila and Dizzy were number one hits, 11 top 40 hits. And if you look in the 1960s, especially once the Beatles got on the scene, it seems like from that you know, early 1963 to 68, 69, if you look at the top 10 songs, they're so good every single week. I mean, the competition to make good records then was really, I mean, it's astonishing. You know, you can look at 10 songs and every one of them is a classic. And that'll be just 1 week's, you know, and then I was thinking, well, there's only so many years and there's only 52 weeks a year. And to have two number one hits in the 60s is really an astonishing thing. I mean, it really makes you part of the fabric of America in a way.
Well, yeah, I was very fortunate. And another thing that made it very difficult in the 60s, especially after the Beatles came to America, was after the Beatles, you had an influx of a lot of different British acts. So it pushed a lot of the American artists off the charts. And I was very fortunate to be able to write my own material because I think the songwriting is really what kept me in the charts, because if I hadn't been able to write my songs and kind of create I had to also create a niche for myself with the bubblegum thing. I mean, we did that all on purpose. You know, I had to find something that nobody else was doing, and I kind of created this character, Tommy Rowe, bubblegum singer, you know, and it sustained me through the whole decade of the 60s with all the British acts that pushed the American acts off the charts. So I was very fortunate. I had a lot of great musicians on my records, too, you know, so I had a lot of help. I didn't do it by myself.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that you wrote so many of your hits because a lot of times, I mean, the ultimate expression of bubblegum music is the Archies, who, you know, not only did they not write their songs, they don't exist. They're cartoons, you know. I think people get sort of lumped into that bubblegum thing as being part of this factory of callous hit making or teeny bopper stars. But no, Tommy Rowe wrote a lot of his own songs and a lot of those big giant hits, and it's amazing. You talked about working with different people. You started out in Atlanta, Georgia, where you're from, and there was a kind of an amazing little scene there. Mac Davis and Billy Joe Royal and Ray Stevens and Joe South were all from around there, and all kind of as really youngsters all made records down there at what was that guy, Bill?
Bill Lowry, Lowry group, Lowry Studios.
He was just the kind of linchpin. And then you go down to Nashville and you made records right off the bat with the absolute A-team of those Nashville guys. I mean, the absolute those guys were playing on every hit country record going, and then in L.A. you played with all the Wrecking Crew guys, and in Rick Hall's studio you played with those guys when they were at the peak of their thing, and you know, Gary Paxton and Steve Clark and Kurt Betcher and Steve Barry, all these guys are big names. You seem to always be at the right place at the right time. Was that you? How did that all work out?
Well, I was always looking for, you know, someone that could understand what I was trying to accomplish, you know, and with Felton, you know, when I recorded Sheila the second time, you know, you played the first version of Sheila earlier, but when I recorded Sheila the second time, Felton Jarvis was just out of the Marine Corps, and he was a printer in the building where our studio was, and he used to hang out in the studio all the time, and he talked me into re-recording Sheila. But he said, we're going to do it differently. We're going to put some drums in there and do kind of a tribute to Buddy Holly. It'll be like a tribute to Buddy Holly kind of deal. And so, you know, he took me to Nashville. He lined up all the musicians along with Bill Lowry. And, you know, I had Bob Moore on bass, Buddy Harmon on drums, Jerry Reed was playing guitar, and Wayne Moss was playing guitar. And so we went to Nashville and re-recorded Sheila, and then that became a huge record. And then, you know, that one thing led to another. I moved to New York. I thought I wanted to study acting for a while. I lived up there, and I wrote Sweet Pea in New York, and it's now Winter's Day. And then I moved to L.A. Portland, Dick Clark invited me to be a regular on Where the Action Is back in the mid-60s. And so I moved to L.A. from New York thinking I'd stay there 6 months, and I ended up staying there. I'm still living there. So it was kind of a long move. But when I moved to L.A., then I met Steve Barry and Steve Clark and Kurt Betcher and all these guys and started working with them. You know, we kind of hung out together. I was always kind of trying to be in the middle of the action, you know?
Yeah, you had a great uncanny nose for it. You know, I listened to a lot of these songs, and a lot of the songs are pretty simple songs. They don't have a lot of chords in them. They don't have a lot of, you know, augmented chords or, you know, this song structure, right. But yet there's so many good ideas in each recording, you know? I mean, these are, they're catchy songs, the melodies are great. You know, what was the, was it an intuitive thing, or did you think about, how can we shove some more great ideas into this record? Not enough, you know, because it's amazing, you know, key changes and just string arrangements, background vocals, there's always something new happening in these, you know, 2 minute and 30 second songs.
Right. Well, that was the trick, too, to try to write a song in less than 3 minutes. In those days, radio wouldn't play anything over 3 minutes, so you had to keep it like 2:30, 2:40, 2:50, something like that. But, you know, when I first started writing, you know, Sheila's only three chords, Sweet Pea's only three chords, so we did a lot of modulating after Sheila. They call me the modulator, you know, in the old days, every song I would write, I'd do a modulation in it. But, you know, It's Now Winter's Day was kind of a tricky song, and it was almost a hit record. It was, I think it got in the 30s, but then Dizzy is very tricky chord-wise. So as I went on with my songwriting, I started changing a little bit and doing a lot of chord progressions and modulations in my writing.
Yeah, Dizzy kind of makes you dizzy. There's so many weird modulations in that song. Yeah, it works perfectly.
Well, it modulates in the first two bars. You know, it goes from D, G, B, you know, which is a modulation right there.
Yeah, so, that's a great...
That was the tricky part. I wrote that with Freddie Weller, and I told Freddie, I said, Freddie, we've got to put a modulation in here. You know, they expect it from me. So he said, well, why don't we just do it in the first couple of bars? And I said, well, that sounds cool. Let's try.
Yeah, amazing. Let's talk about Joe South for a moment. He was a guest on this program a couple of years ago. He passed away recently. Just a super talented guy. I mean, just and kind of really a voice of his generation. And I think in sort of, he wasn't really comfortable, I think, with that role. Or I'm not, you know, he seemed like he was sort of uncomfortable with everything. But sweet guy, wrote some amazing songs. What was he like way back in the day there?
Well, Joe was a big inspiration to me. When I was still in high school, Joe was already like a star in the Southeast. You know, he had a hit record called I'm Snowed and Purple People Eater Meets the Witch Doctor or something like that.
Right.
And so I used to kind of follow Joe around when I was a kid. He was a few years older than me. But then, of course, when I got my hit, I was in the same stable. He was with Bill Lowry as well. So I got to meet him, and we became very good friends. But Joe was a very introverted kind of personality, and his songwriting was really about, it really was who he was. I mean, he was an incredible songwriter, very talented songwriter. I mean, he'd written some terrific songs. And so he was never really that outgoing, even though he was performing when I was following him around as a kid, you know. He was performing around the Southeast and doing very well, but later on, he became like a session player. You know, he played on Bob Dylan's album. He played on Aretha Franklin. He played on some of my hits, you know. But he ended up just trying to write songs for other people, and then he'd put an album out here and there. But he never enjoyed going out on the road. After games people play, you couldn't get him to go out on the road. He just didn't enjoy it, you know. But we'll miss him. He's a very talented guy and really a very nice guy. He was very difficult to know. Joe, like I say, he was an introverted personality, and he really stayed to himself. But when you were around him, he was just a sweetheart of a guy, you know. So we'll miss him. He's great talent.
Yeah, he was just a super. There's no one like that anymore. I don't know. It's just the way it works now. There's just that kind of thing just doesn't get through, you know. It's too bad.
No, it's a different ball game, especially for pop rock and country. You still have the songwriting thing. It's very important in country music, but a lot of that's been lost in pop and rock, that, you know, that writing the song and you know, getting the airplay. I mean, for one thing, radio is totally different. You know, you don't really, radio doesn't mean that as much as it used to. I mean, used to, you had to have radio on your side. It's like when I wrote a song, the first thing I would think about was selling it to the DJs. I would think, now, what do they want? You know, what, it's like, you know, like I said earlier, they wanted songs less than 3 minutes. And it's like when I wrote Everybody, I wrote that strictly for radio, and Everybody is only like 2 minutes and 10 seconds long. It's a very short record. But I wrote it for coming out of, they used to say, give me something to come out of the news with, you know. And so I wrote that with that thought in mind, of coming out of the news with a real up-tempo song. So, and then, of course, after you sold the DJs, you had to have something really there for the audience, you know, to really latch on to. So it was a real trick writing those three-minute tunes.
Sure. Let me remind everybody, we're talking with Tommy Rowe. His website's TommyRowe.com, and he's playing at BB King's in New York City on Monday night. I think it's an early show. You can check out BBKingBlues.com for information about that. And this is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Manhopin in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Tommy Rowe is our guest here. It's Michael Shelley. You mentioned DJs. I mean, you always hear about having to bribe DJs in payola. Did you witness any of that? Were you on any end of that?
You know, if it happened, I never saw it. What I would do is, you know, it's just like any business. If you had a DJ that, like a station that you needed to play your record, I mean, I would go to the station and talk and do interviews with them, talk to them. But I never saw any money change hands with DJs. I know a lot of people talk, and maybe it did, but it wasn't something that I was involved with.
All right. Last time you were on the show, you talked about the Beatles. You and Chris Montez did a tour with the Beatles in 63, I believe, and you came back to America and tried to get your record company. You said, boy, there's this great band, you should put them out, and they said, you know, stick to writing songs, kid, you don't know anything about music. And right. Amazing story. But tell me about, I mean, just watching the Beatles, what was, during that time, what was the difference between watching those live shows and the experience we had later, you know, the same experience we have now listening to a Beatles record. What was the difference?
Well, I think the difference in the Beatles, to me, was if you just heard their records, their early records, I mean, if you think about it, they really weren't that impressive. I mean, it's four musicians, you know, really not, they weren't terribly that good in the beginning, but they wrote their own songs, and if you just listened to their records, it wouldn't be that impressive. But when you saw them and you put the image with the records, then that did it for you. It's like when they did our tour over in England, I immediately saw the response from the audience to these four guys when they walked on stage. It was like Elvis all over again, you know?
Yeah, I mean, did you?
So I knew they had that magic, that charisma that caught the eye of the listener. So that was the part that I really enjoyed. And that's why, you know, Brian Epstein, all they talked about was coming to America, and they never really dreamed they'd get to go to America. You know, they were just four young kids trying to do the best they could in the music business. And so when Brian gave me a little Beatles promo pack to take back with me, and I was kind of the star at ABC Records at the time, so I could kind of walk into the office if I wanted to. So I said, sure, I'll take it back and play it for the president and see what they say. And so I did, and they turned them down. And, of course, 6 months later, the Beatles became the Beatles as we know. And then all of a sudden, I was considered a genius, you know.
Did you freak
out?
It
was an interesting time.
Did you freak out when you saw them? I mean, did you realize, okay, music is just taking a giant step forward, you know?
Well, it wasn't that I freaked out. I just saw that they had, I mean, and nobody really knew they'd changed the whole music business. I mean, what they did once they caught on was incredible. I mean, it will probably never be accomplished again. I mean, they changed everything from fashion to music styles. I mean, you name it, in the pop culture, they changed it all. And so I don't think anybody saw that. But what I did see as another entertainer and one who, you know, appreciates talent was the charisma they had. You know, there's a few people, Sinatra had it, Elvis had it, and the Beatles have it. And each individual Beatle has that charisma as well. You know, so the four of them combined, it was just a powerhouse.
Maybe Michael Jackson, like too.
Yeah, Michael Jackson, a fabulous charisma. So, I mean, when you see that, you know it, and it's like the executives in the record companies, they sit in their ivory towers, and they're never out on the street looking at talent. It has to be brought to them. And when you bring it to them and they just listen to the music and they don't see the act, it's not that impressive sometimes. And I think that's what happened when I played the Beatles album for the president of ABC Paramount Records. If he had seen them, he saw their picture on the front of the album, you know, that I brought, and they kind of snickered at that. They thought they looked really weird, you know.
Need a haircut.
At that time, they did. But that was part of their charm, you know, that whole look they had with the hair and everything.
Yeah. So, it's hard to believe now. People literally freaked out because of the Beatles' haircuts. I mean, it was a constant thing at their press conferences. When are you going to get a haircut? It's just, it's hard to believe the world was that different such a short time ago. I don't want to talk about the Beatles for your entire interview, but did you ever cross paths with those guys later on?
Well, when they came to the States, they did the Ed Sullivan Show, and the next day they had a show down in Washington, D.C. at the Washington Coliseum. And Brian Epstein invited me to open the show for them there, which I did. So I opened that show, and then we kind of, you know, then when they took off, we kind of lost touch. I mean, I would speak to them a couple of times, but never really had a chance to hang out with them after that. And then a couple of years ago, Ringo came through Los Angeles, and I was invited to his show backstage, and so I saw Ringo before his show started. It was his last show on the tour, so he was leaving right after the show. So I hung with him a little bit. We reminisced about old times. But, you know, everybody goes their own way. You do your own thing. But if you bump into each other, it's like, you know, you just haven't seen each other since yesterday, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing. You talked about acting. I think you were on a Green Acres episode. Is that right?
Yeah, with my Green Acres, the Ace of Spades or the Ace of Clubs or whatever it was called. And I did my Green Acres thing. Played a character called Tadpole Talbot, kind of a country hayseed character, and it was a lot of fun.
Do you still get royalty checks for that once in a while?
Yeah, you know, a few pennies here and a few pennies there. It's no big deal. But the acting thing. Once I did theater, after I studied acting a little bit, I did some dinner theater, you know, and it was so hard. I mean, you do a show every night, two shows on Saturday, and sometimes matinees, and you have to be up for every show. And I thought, you know, it's so much easier to sit in the confines of my studio and write a song. I think I'll stick to what I really know and enjoy doing and just forget about the acting, because I really admire theater, especially theater actors, because the work they do, and it's 24/7. It's not, there's no let up. You've got to be on constantly. You've got to be up for every show. You've got to get into character. And you're talking about exhausting work. It's really exhausting work. So hats off to the theater people. They're terrific.
Yeah. It's hard. It's hard work. The grass always looks greener until you go over there, and then, wow, yeah. But for a lot of people, writing a hit pop song is really hard work. And you've, like I said, 11 top 40 songs, 2 number one hits. And we sort of talked about this last interview. For some reason, and I really can't quite understand this, some folks who had, you know, top 10 hits in the 60s don't get played on oldies radio today, and some do. And for some reason, your songs, you know, Dizzy and Everybody and Sweet Pea and Hooray for Hazelin, oh, you know, on and on, still get played in top 40, you know, in that oldies radio format, which is, you know, terrific for you. But it's also a testament to just the lasting power of those catchy, kind of timeless recordings. They're just great. And, you know, besides just those songs, you know, your whole catalog is filled with all kinds of experimental stuff and, you know, some more rockabilly stuff and some folky stuff and some country stuff. It's not all that kind of, you know, hot pop music. I hope people,
My writing was kind of diversified, but once I got into that niche, that soft pop rock bubblegum sound, and that was the hit sound, that's what they churned out record-wise. But I've always written different kind of song. I mean, like my new song Devil Soul Pile, that's totally opposite from anything I've ever done. It's kind of a social commentary on our society today in song, which is a bit serious, but I mean, as a songwriter, you write what's in your heart. It comes out, and you have to write it. You know, you can't just let it sit there. So
that's amazing that you're still.
You know, I try to explore different ideas with my songwriting and go as far with it as I can. And songwriting to me is something that comes in spurts to it. And when it happens, when I get that feeling to write, I have to write a lot because it may go away. I might not write another song for 2 years, and I've actually gone through those periods where I don't write anything for years, you know, and all of a sudden I'll get the urge to write and start at it again, you know.
I'm looking forward to hearing Devil's Soul Pile. We haven't got it here. I'd like to hear that. The show is Monday night at BB King's. You'll be hearing some of the hits, some of the B-sides, some of the oddball stuff. I really can't wait, and I'm sure you've got a good band together to kind of do it. And it's, like I said, I think it's an early show, BB King's in the heart of Times Square in New York City. This Monday, coming right up. Check out bbkingblues.com for information or tommyrowe.com for information. Tommy, we heard that version of Sheila to start off the show. I figured let's end also with Sheila. I queued up the LP version. It was a huge hit. It's, again, one of those songs. Who plays on this one, the hit version?
That's right. Buddy Harmon. Buddy Harmon on drums and Jerry Reed on guitar, Wayne Moss on guitar, Bob Moore, who had a record called Mexico.
Sure, Bob Moore. We've had him on the show. Tell me, how old are you when you made this record?
I was 20 years old.
Oh, my God. It's unbelievable.
And Sheila, that version you played, I was like 16 or 17 years old. Amazing. I was just a kid.
Well, we've interviewed a lot of folks on this show, and I don't think we've ever had a nicer guy than you or a guy with a better memory than you. So thanks very much.
It's my pleasure, Mike.
And we'll see you Monday at BB King's. I'm going to be there. I'm looking forward to the show. I will see you there.
Fantastic, Mike. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. Have a great day.
Sweet little Sheila, you'll know her if you see her. Blue eyes and a ponytail. Her cheeks are rosy, she looks a little nosy. Man, this little girl is fine. Never knew a girl like a little Sheila. Her name drives me insane. Sweet little girl, that's my little Sheila. Man, this little girl is fine. Sheila, go for a ride. Oh, 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 I feel a funny inside. Then little Sheila whispers in my ear. Oh, 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 I love you, Sheila, dear. Sheila said she loved me. She said she'd never leave me. True love will never die. We're so doggone happy just being around together.
Is there a better song than that? I don't think there is. Couldn't be. That is Tommy Rowe, of course, Caveman, and before that, Sweet Pea, and a bunch of Tommy Rowe songs before that. And joining us on the phone live is Tommy Rowe. Welcome to the program, Tommy.
Thank you, Michael. You said you were going back to the beginning. You weren't kidding.
Well, the Caveman is before the, it's, you know, it's B.C. That's the beginning.
I'm telling you.
What a fantastic hit that is. I mean, that is just a number one hit. And what's so great about so many of these songs, now we just heard about 10 Tommy Rowe songs, is that most of them you wrote, which is so different from so many folks who had hits in the 60s.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, when I was a young kid, about 14, my dad taught me to play the guitar. Well, he taught me three chords, so I thought I could play the guitar. But I immediately started trying to use the guitar as an instrument to write songs. You know, I was kind of a shy kid. I never dreamed I'd end up being a performer, actually being on stage myself. But I started out just trying to write songs for other people, and I would send my songs out, and I would never get any responses to my my inquiries about recording my music. So finally, I put a little band together in high school, and we started playing around local venues around Atlanta, and next thing I knew, I was on stage.
Yeah, now you're Tommy Rowe.
Now I'm Tommy Rowe.
You're the
yeah.
Tommy Rowe. You were actually born Tommy Rowe just about at Atlanta, Georgia. Is that right?
That's correct. Thomas David. And May 9th, 1942. So it'll make me 67 in May.
And you've had 11 top 40 hits in the USA and lots of hits all over the world. So tell me about growing up. Your dad taught you to play guitar. So obviously it wasn't one of those things where you were had to sneak rock and roll into your house. Were they kind of open to that?
Well, no, actually they weren't. It's kind of a funny thing. When I was, maybe in the 10th or 11th grade. In Atlanta, you would hear, in the daytime, you would just hear the pop music, like you'd hear Patti Page and Sinatra stuff and this kind of music. And then at night, about 10 or 11 o'clock, you'd hear, you know, the rhythm and blues would come on the radio. So I used to sneak my little transistor radio into the covers with me at night when I would go to bed, and I would wait till WAKE was the station in Atlanta, and I would wait till that station came on, and I would stay up all night listening to this music under my covers, you know, and Mother would wonder the next morning why I couldn't get up and go to school, you know.
That's so funny. That is the exact story so many people tell, literally under the covers with the transistor radio.
That's true, yeah.
You're born the perfect age, you know, you're born in 42, which makes you the perfect age to sort of get the rock and roll spell cast over you. You know, Elvis and Buddy Holly and, you know, all those guys were coming along just as you were sort of the age, you know, 12 to 17, a perfect age to be corrupted by rock and roll.
That's exactly it. I was in high school. Excuse me. I was in high school when, of course, Elvis kicked off his career, and Buddy Holly and Carl Perkins and all these guys, and, of course, Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
And I really loved the singer-songwriters, you know, so I really tried to do a lot of their songs in my, when we would perform it with my band, I would cover their songs, you know. So they were very influential with me as far as my songwriting and my record making went.
So that area of Atlanta at that time was a real birthplace for a lot of guys came out of that area, a lot of guys around your age. Were you palling around with those guys? Was it?
Oh, yeah, sure. There used to be a show in Atlanta called the Georgia Jubilee, and they would bring artists from Nashville into town, and then on the bill with them would be the local artists. And I used to go to these shows when I was still in high school, and I saw Jerry Reed and Joe South and Ray Stevens and all of these artists from Atlanta, you know. So I was a big fan of theirs when I was just starting out, and they were already making records, you know. So I met them and grew up with them, and we were all kind of under the same umbrella there in Atlanta with the Lowry Group, you know.
Yeah, it's an amazing, vital scene down there. You went to Brown High School, and you started a band called The Satins. And what kind of gigs were you playing while still in high school?
Well, we would play the high school dances, of course, after the basketball games. And then later on, we progressed into the fraternity parties at Georgia Tech and University of Georgia, so we were moving up the ladder there.
What did it pay to play a fraternity party?
You know, if we got $100 a night, it was great. We could split that four ways, you know, and that was a big night for us. But, you know, the money wasn't the thing. It was we just loved to play, and we didn't tell them this, but we'd have probably done it for nothing if it just let us set up and play for them, you know?
Yeah, so tell me, we just heard Caveman there, I think recorded probably in 59 is my guess?
Yeah, right. I was still in high school then, yeah. That was my, well, actually, I cut Sheila before the hit version of Sheila.
Right.
I recorded it first and while I was still in school, and it was, you know, totally different version. It didn't have the Buddy Holly drums in it. It had just a straight 2/4 beat.
Tell me about writing these songs. I mean, you're in high school. How did you say I'm going to write a song about Caveman or about Sheila? Was it just inspiration?
Let's just say my imagination was kind of wild back then. You know, I don't know where it comes from, Michael. I think songwriting is a gift, and I still write today. You know, I'm not recording anymore, but I continue. I wrote a song the other day called Love Blind, and I actually dreamed the song. And I woke up, and I keep my little, of course, I use my cell phone now, and I record into my cell phone, but I used to keep a little tape recorder next to my bed all the time, because I never knew when I would come up with these ideas. And all of a sudden, I woke up the other night, and I haven't done this in a long time, and I wrote this. I got up in about 3 o'clock in the morning and wrote this song, and it took me about 20 minutes to write it, you know, so I don't know where it comes from. It's just a gift from God, and I've used it well, and I've really enjoyed it. And I hope I make people happy with it. That's great.
Well, you've made tons of people happy. So you're in Brown High School, and you walk into a Satins rehearsal, and you've got a song like Caveman or Sheila. And do the guys in the band understand that? Did they say, you know, hey, these songs are as good as what we're hearing on the radio, or were they? How did you know? Did they understand at that time that you had something special?
Well, you know, there was a DJ in Atlanta. You may have remember him. His name was Paul Drew. He was a big DJ in the South at WGST. And he used to book us at his, what we call sock hops back in those days. You know, he would play music, and then he'd have a band come and perform in between. And he really took a liking to Tommy Roe and the Satins and started booking us on all of his dates. And then when he started playing our records, the first one he played was a song called I Got a Girl. And that became a very big hit in the Southeast. It didn't spread nationally, but it became a hit locally there in Georgia and Alabama, you know, in that area. So he was very instrumental in getting our records played. And when we heard them on the air with, you know, next to Buddy Holly or next to Carl Perkins, I mean, we thought, wow, you know, it works. It sounds good to me, you know. So we were very happy with what we were doing. We thought we were right in there with the big guys, you know.
Yeah. And so who produced Caveman? Is it Felton Jarvis?
No, Felton started producing me when we cut the hit version of Sheila.
So how did he find you? I mean, that guy went on to produce loads and loads of Nashville, you know, hit mainstream country.
Yeah.
So how did Felton find you?
Well, I used to record in a studio there in Atlanta. It was called NRC, National Recording Corporation. And Felton used to work in the back, and there was an office in the back where they had a printing office back there. And he was just out of the Marines. He'd just gotten out of the service. And he took this job in this printing office, but he was always hanging out at the studio. I mean, he never was on his job. You know, he was so into the music thing. And so I met him just hanging out at the studio there, and he used to mimic Elvis when he was in the Marines. He was a huge Elvis fan. And he would, you know, lip-sync Elvis songs and mimic him on stage for the officers' clubs in the Marines. So when he thought when he heard all the music there in the studio, he told me, he said, look, I want to get into the music business. I can't sing, I can't play a guitar really, but I got to do something, so I'm going to become a producer. And we all thought, yeah, of course, you know, we've heard that before. So sure enough, he got me and convinced me to record, you know, and he's the guy that put the deal together to go to Nashville and record Sheila. We re-recorded Sheila, so that was his first hit. No, actually, he'd worked with Ray Stevens on Gladys Knight and the Pips. Ray Stevens produced that song in the same studio with Every Beat of My Heart, I think the song was, her first record.
And did it turn out that Felton, did he sort of put the beat into Sheila? Did he whip it into Sheila?
Did. Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, he was a big fan of Elvis and a big fan of Buddy Holly, so he wanted the Buddy Holly drums in there. And his whole objective to get in the music business was to meet Elvis. So once he got successful with me, he produced Everybody, which was a follow-up to Sheila, which was another big record. And so when he started his success as a producer, he moved to Nashville, got a job with Chet Atkins. Next thing you know, he meets Elvis, becomes one of Elvis's best friends, and ends up recording him the last 10 years of before Elvis passed away.
Yeah, I think Elvis was working with Chet Atkins, and Chet was just a little too square for Elvis, and Felton was a little more of a good fit for Elvis.
Oh, Felton was a crazy guy, but a great guy. His office in the studio there in Nashville, they called it the Jungle Room. It was like a had, you know, leopard skins, and he had a bull constrictor pet. You know, I mean, he was a crazy guy. You know,
that sounds like just what you need. Well, Sheila ended up coming out on a small label, Judd, at first, right?
That's correct.
And
yeah,
it ended up becoming a number one hit everywhere. I mean, a great way to sort of start your career, really.
Oh yeah, it was. Well, Sheila was actually the B-side of my first record. When I went to Nashville with Felton, we cut two sides. We cut a song called Save Your Kisses, and we cut, of course, Sheila. And when they released the record, Save Your Kisses was the A-side. And it didn't take off at all, so there was a DJ in Baltimore that flipped the record and started playing Sheila, and it was like an immediate phone record. Mm. People started calling and requesting it, so it was a real quick hit.
So who plays on Sheila? Do you know is it the Satins or is it the Nashville Session guys?
On the original version of Sheila, it was the Satins.
But on the number one hit version?
The number one hit version was Buddy Harmon on drums, Bob Moore was on bass, Jerry Reed and Wayne Moss was on guitar, and Floyd Kramer was playing the keyboard, which you can't really hear, but on Save Your Kisses, the other side of the record, he's playing the organ on that.
Wow, that's quite an amazing...
I had quite a combo there.
Yeah, that is really, those guys are not fooling around, yeah. So, now pretty quickly you end up going to the UK and touring. How did that happen, and, you know, was everybody just going to the UK immediately?
Well, of course, Sheila was the number one record all over the world. It was number one in England, Germany. It was just a huge record. And so I started doing tours around the states, and I did one of the first tours I did was with Sam Cooke and Jerry Butler and the Pressions, and we went through all through the Southeast, and on the bill with me was Chris Montez. And so that was in 1962 when Sheila was a hit. Then in 1963 I got a call about doing a tour in England, and you know, I didn't really care. I just thought it would be really exciting to go to England. Yeah, anyway, whether I was touring or not. So I jumped at the chance, and when I come to find out, Chris Montez and I are the headliners of the tour. So I've already met Chris before, so that was great. So when we got to England to do the tour and we started rehearsing with the band and everything, on the bill with us was this band, a featured act on our tour, on Chris and I, our program, a featured act called the Beatles. And, of course, nobody in 1963 knew who the Beatles were, except they were just kicking off in England in 63. So we did the tour with the Beatles, 30 days out on the bus with these guys, and it was just like magic, you know. I knew immediately they were special, and I knew that they would probably be big. I never dreamed they'd be as huge as they actually turned out, but I knew they were going to be very successful. I even tried to get them a record deal on my label in New York. When we came back to the States, I took their album into ABC Paramount Records and tried to get them to sign them, and the president of the label dropped the needle down on their LP and played a few bars and said, "That's the worst piece of crap I've ever heard, Tommy." Said, "Hey, tell you what, let us be the talent scouts and you be the songwriter. You write the hits and we'll find the talent."
That's pretty funny. So, was the kind of thing where you sat on the side of the stage and watched those guys play, and was it really mind-blowing?
Oh, it was. To tour with them was, I mean, you were in on the ground floor of something you knew with the Beatles, you know, because the audience just went crazy. I remember the first time I saw Elvis, I was still in high school, and he did a show in Atlanta at the old Roxy Theater there. And I was like in the third row down on the left side of the stage, you know, and everything was quiet until he walked on stage. And when he walked on stage, the audience just erupted. It stood up. You could never see him or hear him, you know. And so when I worked with the Beatles, I said, "My God, this is like when I saw Elvis," you know. Yeah. So I knew something was happening.
Yeah. What fun. And touring with all those Sam Cooke and the Impressions and stuff, that must have been a ride, too. Was everybody on the same bus and having fun together?
Yeah, that was an interesting time because of the times. You know, this was still in the early 60s. You know, we were still segregated in the South in a lot of places. And, you know, I caught a lot of flack about, in fact, I got threats from all kinds of people about doing that tour, being on the bus with the African-American troop, you know.
Yeah, things in Atlanta still pretty dicey around then.
Yeah, back then, we went into Mississippi and Alabama, and I actually left the tour, and when we went into Nashville, there was a show in Nashville, and there was about a week left in the tour, and I'd started getting these phone call threats at my hotels when I would check in, you know, so my manager decided to pull me off the tour.
Wow.
So it was, you know, it was terrible, all of that, because, you know, really the reason they would have, in the early days, when the black troops would go out on tour, they would usually have at least one act or one white act or two white acts on the show, and the reason for that was that they couldn't go in the restaurants in the South, and they couldn't check into the hotels in the South. And so what I would do, they'd park the bus down the street a ways, and you have to remember, too, there were no McDonald's or Burger Kings back then. They were all mom-and-pop cafes or diners, you know. So they'd park the bus down the road a ways, and I would walk up and order, like, 40 hamburgers for everybody, you know. So I was really the guy to fetch the food, to be able to get them in the door, in and out. And when we would pull into a town on our tour, you know, they'd drop Chris and I off. They call me the token white, and they call Chris Mr. In-Between. And so they would drop Chris and I off at a hotel, which would, again, would be a mom-and-pop hotel. They weren't even Holiday Inns back then, very few if there were any. And then they would go into the black community, and they would stay at people's houses, or if they happened to be a African-American hotel, they would check a few people in there, but they really had no place to stay, you know. So it was a very interesting time. The history now, is some of it's kind of ugly, but I'm glad we got through it, and I wouldn't trade any of my experiences for anything, because I was treated wonderfully by everybody that I worked with back then.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and it's not that long ago. You know, that's what we have to remember. Let me remind everybody, we're talking here to Mr. Tommy Rowe, and joining us live actually from Mexico this morning.
not a bad phone connection, actually, considering all that. Yeah, everybody came out. We heard from that earlier. Another giant hit, and then you had a little stint in the Army, right?
I did. Everybody was the big record, and I started getting a lot of requests then to work in England, so I actually moved over to England. I just rented a place over there because I was working over there so much and enjoying it. I loved working. You know, I worked with all the Cilla Black, all the early entertainers of the 60s, you know, Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas and Jerry and the Pacemakers, and I toured with all these guys. And so I just rented an apartment over there and worked over there, and then I started getting my papers from Uncle Sam. They were about to draft me in 1964, so I decided I would come back to the States and join the reserves, which I did. I joined the National Guard first, and I was in for 6 months, and then I got out and I was in the Army Reserve. So I was actually in the Army Reserves until 1971.
Wow.
That's why my hair was always kind of long and short. I'd have to go to my meetings and cut my hair off, so I was never really able to let my hair grow as long as I wanted it to.
That's amazing. So what years exactly did you live in the UK?
Right during everybody, 63 and early part of 64. Probably about almost a year.
Gotcha. Okay, so you come back 1966, and you cut the giant hit Sweet Pea with Gary Paxton, another colorful character, to say the least.
Yeah.
Tell me
I seem to hook up with those guys.
Tell me about working with Gary, and, you know, that song is just, you hear the first couple bars of that, and it's all over. I mean, that just is a number one hit, you know?
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. I wrote it. Yeah. Such a fun song. It always brings a smile to people's face, and I love that. Well, you know, I wrote that... actually, when I wrote that while I was in the Army, and I thought while I was in the service, I'll see if I can get some songs recorded by other people. So I wrote Sweet Pea for the McCoys. They had Hang On Sloopy.
Sure, yeah.
And I'd met Burt Burns in New York, and I told him I had this song for the McCoys, and I sent it to him, and I never got any reply. You know, it's one of those things you think, well, at least they'll call me and say that they didn't like it, you know, but you get no reply. You figure, well, that means... It's not on the agenda. So I did. That was my demo that I sent to them. So when I got out of the service, I hooked up with Steve Clark, who was out in California, and he was working with Gary Paxton. And so I told Steve I'd like to record Sweet Pea. You know that he'd heard the demo, and we played the demo over and over. And he said, you know, let's not record. Let's just put it out. Let's just put the demo out. And so we put the demo out. That was the demo.
So who's playing on that?
On Sweet Pea, we've got Jerry Sheff is on bass, who ended up playing with Elvis, you know.
Mm-hmm.
On drums, we had Jim Troxell. Jim passed away a few years ago. Mike Dacey on guitar. And I was playing acoustic. I used to play acoustic guitar on all those songs that we did in California.
And has anybody ever sampled that record? Has that drum beat been used by anybody?
It's been sampled many times, and I think I got credit for it maybe once. But it's been sampled a lot. Dizzy and Sweet Pea are big sample records.
I'll bet they are, because that isolated great drum sound is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's another one that you wrote. Let's talk about that for a minute. I mean, the difference financially in being the writer of all these number one hits, I mean, that's the difference between, I would imagine, you know, having to work to pay your mortgage and working when you want to, because you want to at this point.
Well, it's true. The songwriting is really, for me, it's carried me through the valleys in the business. And, you know, the record business is just peaks and valleys constantly. You're just up and down. But when the 70s came along, disco started happening. It put a lot of performers out of work. I mean, there just wasn't that much work unless you were a disco act and you could go into the disco clubs, you know. So probably the mid-70s to the latter part of the 70s, I don't think I performed maybe five times during that period.
Mm. Wow.
And so the songwriting is what just kept me going because, we'd get the songs re-recorded. I was looking through some old sheet music the other day, and you mentioned Aggravation, you know, the song I wrote called Aggravation.
Yeah, sure.
That was actually recorded in England by the Searchers, and I'd totally forgotten about it.
Right. I think it's credited to the drummer of the Searchers.
So the songs were being recorded, and you'd pick up a little money here and a little money there, and then if you got a commercial or something, you know, it'd be more money. So the songwriting is just what carries you through. I mean, it's just, it's, to me, that's the business.
Yeah,
a song, you got to have the song first.
There must be about 50 versions of Dizzy, I would imagine. I mean,
there's a lot of versions of Dizzy. It's been in a lot of movies, a lot of commercials. And
yeah, that's great. Hooray for Hazel, another big top 10 hit here and in the UK. And then we Aggravation, like produced by Kurt Betcher, right?
Yeah, Kurt was kind of ahead of his time out in California. He was a very talented young man, and I hooked up with Kurt through Steve Clark, and we did the album, It's Now Winter's Day, was the first one we did, and Kurt did all the vocal backgrounds. He was just really a genius with vocals, and we cut a song that I wrote. I actually started writing It's Now Winter's Day like 2 years before I finished it, and it was... I'm sure you've heard the song, but we released it, and we thought it was going to be a huge hit. It charted pretty well, started charting well. We released it in the winter. It's like a very winter song, and it turned out to be one of the warmest winters on record, so the stations just stopped playing it, you know. And so it really didn't move up the charts like we thought it would. But Kurt, actually, we were recording in the CBS studios, and in the next studio from us, the Beach Boys were recording Good Vibrations and all that good stuff they were doing back then. And they were the first one to use the oscillator on, you know, their records.
The theremin, or yeah.
Yeah, the theremin, yeah. So Kurt went over, they were out, they'd left the studio, so Kurt went over and nicked their theremin and brought it over to our studio, and we used it on It's Now Winter's Day. Then he ran and put it back. He said, boy, I hope they don't catch us, you know.
Yeah, he ended up working with the association and having a bunch of great big hits. And another, you know, you crossed paths with so many talented people. That's definitely a more psychedelic sort of record. Were you trying to change your image sort of, or was it just let's try something new?
Well, I think the Beatles had influenced a lot of us with their music in the mid-60s. You know, they were Strawberry Fields and all those great records. And we were all experimenting, you know, rock and roll was really going into a different direction, and it was a great experimentation for me because I was writing a lot of songs during that period. I was just really pouring them out, turning them out, you know. So we would experiment with different sounds, different techniques of recording, and it's like on It's Now Winter's Day, we used a mallet on the piano strings and a piano and just recorded that on a separate track and then played it backwards. Into the track. I mean, everybody was doing stuff like that, you know, and it was really an exciting time in the studio because we just had, you know, up until that time, I'd only recorded stereo, and all of a sudden we had three tracks, and then we had four tracks, so everybody was going nuts with all these tracks, trying to, you know, fill them up and do great things, you know. So then, of course, we went to 8 tracks and 16, and, you know, the rest of the story.
That's interesting because those, you know, those early hits of yours just sound so huge, you know, considering how, you know, they're 2 or 3 tracks, you know.
Well, you know, everybody was cutting Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and it was just a monaural record. I mean, when we left the studio, we had our mix. It was all done live. And Sheila was like a 3-track record, you know. That in Nashville, they already had 3 tracks. But when I cut in Alabama, everything was either mono or just stereo. So Rick Hall was the engineer on those records, and he would actually mix the thing as we recorded. And it took a lot of takes. We'd record like 16 or 20 takes sometimes, you know, a lot of takes. And usually when I record, I do it in like 2 or 3 times, it's done, you know. But we would record over and over and over again, and finally he'd get it the way, and Felton was the producer, and they'd finally get it the way they wanted to hear it.
So everybody's recorded in Muscle Shoals, and Rick Hall's the engineer. And so that was recorded, there's no multi-track tape, it's just recorded straight down to one track.
Just monaural, yeah. We walked out of the studio, and that was our record. We just, you know, made records from it.
Don't have to mix. That's amazing. So who plays on that record? Which band?
On that was David Briggs on keyboards, Jerry Carrigan on drums, Norbert Putnam on bass, and my guitar player from Atlanta, from the Satins, was playing guitar on that. That was Bobby West.
You got a great memory. I'll give you that much.
Well, it's hanging there for an old guy, I guess.
Now, sometimes I hear you referred to as the father of bubblegum music. I've read that a few times, kind of doing research for this. Is that something that feels good or feels not so good?
Oh, no, it's great. I think when it first happened, they called me the king of bubblegum. And the DJs were kind of using it as an off side remark, you know, and it was not really a compliment. It was just kind of a throwaway thing, you know. So I kind of resented it. But, you know, you think about it, bubblegum music is still alive. I mean, you got the Jonas Brothers today. I mean, they're bubblegum.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't care what anybody says. That's what they are. And, you know, that's the audience that buys those records, are the teens and preteens. And so, you know, it was good to me. And I, like I said, a lot of my songs were uplifting and happy songs. And that's really what counts.
Maybe you can send your new song, Love Blind, to the Jonas Brothers. Maybe that's...
Yeah, wouldn't that be great?
There's
a Jonas Brothers recording.
You know, one thing I've noticed about oldies format radio is that as the years go by, they sort of shed songs. There's certain songs that they don't play anymore, even though they were giant hits in the 50s or 60s. But the Tommy Rowe songs remain, you know, still played over and over. Do you have any idea how many times a year or in their lifetime those songs have been played? Do you get any of that data?
Well, I've had two of my... Of course, I'm with BMI, Broadcast Music. For the people in the audience that don't know, we have two organizations, ASCAP and BMI, and they actually log airplays for all of the songwriters. And so Sheila and Dizzy are both multi-platinum or multi-million airplays. And it's like 5 million or 4 or 5 million airplays, whatever it is. And then the rest of them, Sweet Pea is close behind. It's like it's over a million airplays. So I have four of those certificates for million airplays.
I can't argue with that. Tell me about, you were signed to, you know, most of your big records came out on the ABC Paramount label. They sort of lured Ray Charles away from Atlantic and sort of made a bid to be a big label, but not a label that you think of as like one of the pioneers of breaking lots of rock records. Was it a good company to be with, and did you get your just, do you think they paid you fairly?
I don't think any of the labels back then really were, you know, upright with the... especially the African-American artists. I think a lot of them got the shaft, got the raw end of the deal. But, no, you didn't, you know, as far as record royalties, as far as the singer goes, you never really expected any royalties because they would, you know, you'd go in a studio and you'd spend money to record and they would charge that against your royalties. And it seemed to never come out to where you were on top, even though you were selling tons of records. And so... later on, when they were, you know, ABC Dunhill got together, you know, they became a label. ABC Paramount was sold to ABC Dunhill, and then, of course, Universal. And after when that started happening, when the labels merged like that, you started getting better accountings. And of course, we started writing better contracts, too. You have to remember, when I was a kid, I mean, the music business was really, and just starting out, it was an unstructured form of business. And people were just... flying by the seat of their pants trying to put things together. I mean, if you look at some of the contracts that were written back then, I mean, you would never, nobody would ever suggest you sign something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But that's the way it was, and we all survived, and it gave us a chance to get out there and do our thing and make our music, so you have to balance it out, and all in all, I think if you can hang in there and make it work for you, you have the chance, you have the opportunity, then it works out, you know.
Yeah. You've got a great website, TommyRowe.com. There's tons of information, song samples and pictures and all kinds of stuff up there. How many gigs a year are you playing these days?
Well, you know, I retired from performing about 3 years ago, so I'm not doing any shows at all. I miss my buddies out there who's still out there working. I made so many friends all over the world, really, with the musicians and the other entertainers I worked with, but I haven't performed now in 3 years, and I get a request every once in a while to do something, and I may, you know, when you retire from performing, it's like a joke, really, because you can always come back and do it if you feel like doing it, so, but, I, you know, I get some requests to go out occasionally, and if it's something interesting, sounds like it might be fun, it's not just going out to make money or something, you know, I'll probably... get back out there eventually.
You got the itch. So what do you do to keep busy, and what kind of music do you listen to when you drive to the supermarket?
Well, in traffic, I listen to classical music. L.A. traffic is really classical music.
Gotta stay so you don't shoot anybody.
Yeah, but I listen to the oldies stations a lot. That's you know, I still love the oldies, the 60s especially, and I listen to some country, and I try to keep up with the alternative. I like alternative, too, a lot of the college radio stations. And on the Internet now, you can hear a lot of different kinds of music.
Yeah.
And I think the songwriting in the alternative vein area is very good. They're very creative songwriters in there.
Hmm.
And So I try to listen to everything. I haven't been able to get into the rap thing. I've even tried to listen to that, but I just can't quite catch on to what that is. And well, that's just probably my age. I don't know. But.
Yeah, I've got a hard time with 98% of that as well. Well, speaking of oldies, I've got Dizzy queued up here, and it was a number one hit everywhere. Again, like around the whole world, 1969, a giant hit written by you and Freddie Weller. Who's Freddie Weller?
Freddie was a friend of mine in Atlanta, and he was starting out as a songwriter and a country artist. And then when I moved to California in 1965, I was a regular on Dick Clark's Where the Action Is, and I worked with Paul Revere and the Raiders a lot. And Paul had his band, and he lost his guitar player, and he remembered seeing Freddie working with Billy Joe Royal. Freddie used to play guitar with Billy Joe Royal on the road. And he wanted to know if he could get in touch with Freddie, that he'd like to talk to him about hiring him with the Raiders. And so I put them together, and Paul ended up hiring Freddie, and Freddie moved to California then to be with the Raiders and Where the Action Is and all of that. So he worked with the Raiders all that time, and it was perfect for us because we had already started writing together in Atlanta. And when he moved to California, we just started writing together again, and we wrote some, you know, Dizzy and Jam Up and Jelly Tight. We wrote some really big records together.
Yeah, amen to that. You're listening here to WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. Tommy Rowe, who plays on this number one record, Dizzy?
That's Hal Blaine on drums, Joe Osborne on bass, Mike Dacey again on guitar, and on keyboard is Larry Nechtel, and Don Randy played on some of it.
Again, the cream of the crop, once again.
Yeah, the Wrecking Crew out in Los Angeles.
Now, what's it like when you walk in there? Is there sheet music for Dizzy, or you just run it down with a guitar, and then they work it up? How long does it take to create this number one hit song?
Well, I would get together with one of the guys in the band, usually the guitar player, and he'd put together a chord sheet. Like in Nashville, they'd just do the number chord sheets, you know, 1, 4, 5.
Right.
They do it that way. Out in L.A., they would actually write out a chord sheet. And then I'd just go to the studio and run it down with the guitar, and we'd start just rehearsing it. Like, and I always like to let the musicians have an input into the tracks, you know, because, I mean, you know, the drummer is a drummer. He knows better than I do about what to do in certain things. I might have an idea, but I let them do what they want to do. And we eventually come together with a good-sounding thing, and then we turn the machine on, start recording, and just run it till we get a track.
Hmm.
And then I would come back in after that and do my vocals, and this was, of course, when we did multi-tracking.
So how long is Dizzy something that was done in a day or a morning? Or
Dizzy was recorded on a session where we chose another song to be the single. It was a song called Gotta Keep Rolling Along, which I'm sure you remember that one. It did nothing. So we released Gotta Keep Rolling Along, and it just didn't catch on at all. So we had a track on Dizzy, and I liked it, but it was just not quite there yet. So we decided to have some strings put on it.
Mm.
And I just went blank on the guy who did the arranging, famous arranger in L.A., He'll kill me next time he sees me.
That's all
but
right.
Anyway, he did an arrangement on Dizzy. He did the string arrangement, and I had just a scratch vocal on there. And then we heard it with the strings, and we thought, wow, that sounds really cool.
Now, I always wondered, those guys in the Wrecking Crew, they played on literally thousands of top 40 hits. I mean, I imagine, Hal Blaine, he's been on this show, he's played on hundreds and hundreds of hits. When they record a song like Dizzy, do they want to go in the recording booth and hear it back, or were they just so blasé about it, couldn't be bothered, you know?
Well, they were very conscientious about their work. I mean, if there was a little something in there that was wrong, they'd either do it again or edit it, you know, make it right.
Hmm.
So they would listen very carefully to what they did. I mean, they didn't want anything going out to where another musician could say, well, what was Hal doing there, you know?
He's slipping, yeah.
Yeah, no, they're very conscientious. That's why they did such great tracks for everybody. I mean,
that's very interesting.
They really had an input into making the music, so it was very special. And the guys in Nashville were the same way that I worked with there, David Briggs and Jerry Carrigan, Norbert Putnam, they were all in there suggesting and making, giving ideas and the whole thing.
I mean, guess that makes sense. It's their currency. You know, that's the, you're only as good as your last hit, and they want to sound fresh. And to, that's how they get their next job. Well, Tommy Rowe, it has really been great to hear the story behind the story of all these fantastic songs, and I hope you do record some more and maybe play some more gigs and you know, drop by the studio next time you're in New York. I'd love to.
Sounds good, Michael. It's been a pleasure, and you never know what lies ahead in the future, and hopefully I'll see you out there on the road somewhere.
Yeah. Hopefully. Anything else we need to know about Dizzy?
Not really. Maybe you can play it now and some of the people can remember it. Who knows?
I will do that. Thank you, Tommy.
Okay, bud.